So I'd like to introduce my good friend Linda Lintieri. Linda is a longtime educator, many, many years as a teacher, administrator, and progressive thinker and world changer, and also the founder of the Inner Resilience Program, and she'll tell you more about what that is. But it's made some big changes in New York City and among the schools. And she's also one of the founding members of the Mind and Life Education Research Network, she and Mark Greenberg. She's also a founding member of CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic Social Emotional Learning. So she has a lot to share today. And she's going to sort of wrap up what we've done today
for
the last 2 days.
Thank you very much. So one of the things I thought about this morning, I've been trying to meditate before the meditation of the morning, and I've been successful both days, is that in West Africa, there's a wonderful ritual that I realized as it came to me this morning in my quiet time. It's just such a beautiful example of present moment awareness, and some of you may be familiar with it. That when folks from this area greet each other, one of them, and it could be one or the other, says, "I see you." And the other person says, "I am here." And they say, "I see you." And the other person says, "I am here." And I thought we would begin this morning that way. So I see you.
I see you.
You are here. You are here too. And I am here. So thank you. Thank you. Well, what a wonderful and humbling experience to be the closing speaker. And I'll explain a little bit why it might be for me a very new experience. Because usually I'm an extremely spontaneous speaker. And I am having beginner's mind this morning in the real reality sense of it. You know how beginner's mind is to look at something as if you're doing it or seeing it for the first time before? Well, you're experiencing me doing a PowerPoint in beginner's mind, but it's for real. So I just wanted to say that to you, and I am thinking that I might have had the wisdom and intuition to know what I should be saying or want to say that reflects the pictures, or the pictures might be really about something else that I don't know what it is until I see the picture. So I'm going to go either way here. I think the thing I also thought about this morning as I was preparing to speak is I think many of us have expressed to each other first how grateful we were and are that we have met each other, that we have recognized each other. And I have to start first by giving gratitude to this place, the Garrison Institute, and in particular to you, Tish, who held the vision for this to happen.
I just have to thank Deanna Rose, because without Deanna Rose, we wouldn't be here. This place wouldn't be here. This vision wouldn't be here. So I just want to acknowledge and thank Deanna.
And I was about to say that as well, in that I came here, and I was telling Deanna this last night. I came here about, I can't remember if it was 3 or 4 years ago, very small beginning meeting to begin to talk about the things we're talking about here. And I felt in the walls that this could be the place that could hold this vision and bring us together. And I feel like we are really actualizing that in a very real way. I think that we will look back to this conference and possibly see it as a very pivotal event that has happened in each of our individual lives and also our collective lives of the work we're doing in the world. I would definitely say that the Hopi elders in their prophecy said something that I think is true of us. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And I'm grateful we found each other, because sometimes it takes a very long time on this road when we're doing this innovative kind of thing to find each other. So every time I found another one of you, it was the feeling of gratitude. It was the feeling of gratitude. I'd like to talk a little bit today about some of the things that we might want to think about in a bigger way around all of this work. I want to try to get at some of the things we may or may not have spoken about and try to summarize, really, some of what we've been talking about. And some of you know that Parker Palmer has influenced my work greatly, and one of the pieces that I take from him more than any other piece is this concept that he talks about of living divided no more. Of living divided no more. That we would allow the truth we know on the inside to be manifest in our lives on the outside. And I think that as we are dealing with this particular work in the world, that's really a lot of what most of us are doing. We've had an experience on the inside that we are figuring out how to bring to the outside in whatever role we may find ourselves in. I've been in the field of education for about 40 years, and as Tish said, in a variety of capacities. I always tell folks that I started to teach at the year there was a presidential election, and the biggest question I didn't want kids to ask me was, who was I voting for the President of the United States? Because I was 20, I couldn't vote at that point, and I was responsible for the lives, hearts, and spirits of 37 children in East Harlem. And I spent most of my career in education, first as a teacher, assistant principal, principal in the New York City schools, and then co-founding what some of you know the work of, the Resolving Conflict Creatively program, which is a research-based social and emotional learning program in schools. But my actual beginning work in education was really about asking myself the question, how could I integrate the yearning I felt to be actively involved in social justice and change the world? And I did choose the field of education to do that. The first year of teaching was in 1968, the year Martin Luther King Jr. died. And I spent the first part of my career feeling like where I was and what I was doing was clearly beginning to integrate what I cared about in the world and what was happening for me in the field of education. But then I realized what Gandhi said was really true, that if we're to reach real peace and if we are to wage a real war against war, then we're going to have to begin with the children. And what began to happen is that I started to think about what would it look like if schools could be places that not only nurtured young people's intellectual capacities, but would welcome, would cultivate their hearts, their spirits, and their minds as well, and minds as we're talking about it here today. And so it was in the late 80s, early 90s, that we had in this country a very serious thing happening. We were losing a classroom full of children every 3 days to the killing fields of the streets of this country. And many of us began to say, And I'm going to talk a little bit about this later on. There has to be something that changes inside of us when a movement begins to happen that says, we can't have this anymore. We need to wage peace in our schools. And at that point, we began to see with our work that we could teach young people some very concrete skills in how to manage their emotions, in resolving conflict. It was really before I ever heard the words SEL, social emotional learning. Many small programs that were later research-based started off in the late 80s, early 90s. Most of them were related to evaluations that were being done, action research. Ours was related to, we're losing a classroom full of children every 3 years, and I'm going to do the best we can, first in the New York City schools, and then we went much further than that with the work of the Resolving Conflict Creatively program. But then in the midst of this, Dan Goleman stepped up to the plate, and he released that famous book, Emotional Intelligence. He's written a lot more since. But, you know, it really gave us the permission to talk about the power of emotions. And the second year this book was out, he was speaking at one of our largest conferences. We were letting him in to the field of education. And we were beginning to talk about this concept of emotional intelligence. And, of course, he's taken from what the researchers have given him in this definition, the capacity of recognizing our own feelings and those of others, motivating ourselves, managing our emotions well in ourselves and in our relationships. And so the field of education at that point had a real opening. You know, we don't let too many people in. For those of us that are inside education, we know about this. Like, no, we can't use that. No, we can't use that. No, you don't know our schools. You know, it's not a porous store, public schools. But we were beginning somehow, right time and right place, to allow what was happening in the field of neuroscience, psychology, positive youth development, and we started to make very deep strides. We started to talk about social and emotional learning. And this is one definition that we use at CASEL. There was a groundswell of realization and some scientific evidence to back it up. CASEL at this point was a fledgling organization. Founders were about seven of us, Mark Greenberg and myself being two of the seven, where we began to say what would it look like if we had a group of people that held this vision. This book was very influential in that process because it went to 100,000 educators. We were beginning to see that we were moving forward. We were even moving forward in the sense of saying that some of these skills that we were teaching young people also had some academic connection. And, of course, we have a much, much deeper set of things that we know about now in terms of the research. CASEL then began to play a real big role in how social and emotional learning was being adopted and adapted in schools and trying to move schools from this very fragmented approach where they bring in one program after another. There was a study done that most school districts in this country have 14 or more programs that deal with social emotional learning and they don't even know what they are. And that CASEL was beginning to say, you know, if you all got together, you could be integrating all of this a lot better. And you wouldn't have to fight over the money so much either. But the question I was asking myself at that point was, it looks like we're doing a better job at beginning to welcome in children's minds and hearts. But you know what was still being left at the school door? What I would call their inner life. And at that point, this was 2001, August, I had edited a book that's a little prophetic, by the way, because that young girl, I sent about a dozen pictures of our kids that were all signed off on. And they chose this child whose religion is Muslim. And this book came out 10 days before September 11th and hit the bookstores late August of September 11th. And the question I was asking at that point was, is it possible to nurture children's lives, inner lives, in ways that didn't violate the beliefs of families or did not violate the separation of church and state? And when Schools with Spirit came out, honestly, some of you know I was a FESA senior scholar. We each had a project for 3 years, and mine was to write this book, as well as my own self-growth. I think what I felt was, is this is a good start, and we've got about 5 years to go till we really actually start talking about these things in public schools. And, you know, I've got a few more years to give, and, you know, we'll wait. It's okay. This is a good start. People start reading about it, talking about it, et cetera. And then something happened that hastened that. Hastened that in a very, very extreme way for New York City in particular. Young people and teachers began to realize that they had an inner life and that that inner life was in deep need of healing. This picture was drawn by a first grader about 5 hours after the event happened in New York City on September 11, 2001. And most people don't know that on that day, over 8,000 children and 200 teachers and administrators ran for their lives. And both teachers and kids, this was done about a month later. Could I do something about it? This kid is asking, you know. Teachers and young people was struggling with how to integrate what had happened. And remember what Dan said that first night. We can't necessarily, I'm paraphrasing you, Dan, so I apologize. So we can't necessarily change the things that happen to us, but it's what we do with what happens to us, how we integrate what happens to us that makes all the difference. For a teacher, she says, in that instant, I felt like I understood what it means to be a teacher because I could run no faster than that little kindergarten girl could run. I'm happy to say that 6 years later, that group of kids spent a day on retreat with us as they made the transition from elementary school, where their mothers and fathers were able to run and get them, to middle school, which was filled with anxiety for those kids who were the kindergarten kids that ran on that day. And we had many, many day-long retreats for the young people who were very little when this happened. And we had one kindergarten teacher tell her kindergarten class that as long as they kept in touch with her, she would always try to help them make sense of that day in the future. Another little boy is trying to make sense of things. Mike, age 7, he said, look, what really happened is some bad people took rides on the planes. They got in the pilot's room with box cutters. They killed the pilots. They took over the planes, crashed them in the buildings. My heart is beating very fast because I wish I can do something about it. So the helplessness that was there, the void that was there, was quite profound because the unthinkable had happened, and it had happened to a large group of people that were having to go back to their very schools. This is a principal who's in her cafeteria 4 months later, the closest school to Ground Zero, looking into the pit of Ground Zero. And Ada Dulch lost her sister on that day at Cantor Fitzgerald. So this is some of the stuff we were dealing with in terms of integrating and working with what was going on. So what happened? What happened is that a set of what I like to call divine synchronicity and Jung calls meaningful coincidences happened. That the September 11th fund, which was the fund that began at about 1 o'clock on September 11th for the public to donate, had a very large amount of money. And they chose as head of the education part of that money a wonderful principal who taught with me in East Harlem 27 years before. And about 6 weeks later, he walked into my office and made a proposition and said that if I would stop traveling all over the world and keynoting and writing, and I would be willing to help the schools in Ground Zero recover, then we would like to award you a very large grant. And I said, is this the millionaire show? He says, it's about like that. And what happened was that since I was a very trusted person in the largest school district in the country and they knew I wouldn't get them in trouble, I began to get pretty risky, Arthur, you know, talking about last night, really push it to the right to the edge and said, you know, I'd love you to give me all this money, but what I really feel I need to do with it is to begin to nurture teachers' inner lives. And so we began to work with teachers, doing stress reduction work, as you see here. We go to schools, by the way, and give people body work during school time. Over 3,000 of these have been done. Yoga lessons, going on retreats, you name it. Basically, I think, Dan, your expression of teaching people or helping people be their own best friend, and that's what we started to do. And we began to do that in so many different ways. But then teachers began to say, well, this was 3 years in, by the way, you know, this has been so powerful for us. What about the kids? We're ready. We're ready to give this to kids. So it was a very organic process that our curriculum started to happen. And this is where we are now. So I'd like to just shift because I see a little 10-minute thing here and I'm well off on time. So I want to just shift to a couple of things I would leave us with as we do this work in the world. And the first one is this image that what we're really adding to this work is this idea of contemplative practice. That we feel, and many of us in this room, that young people and adults having a regularness of time, that they're quieting their minds and relaxing their bodies in however the different ways we're doing it, is of value. And it's of value not only for what is happening in the moment, but that I think someone said it well, or I put it together in my mind, that states of being become traits. But here's the thing. I know that I've had different conversations with different people of you that we can rush it. We've got to let this work unfold in its time. You know what happens to a chrysalis when you try to help a butterfly emerge, it dies. So we've got to go through stages of this movement. And we've got to start off with the stage that Parker Palmer calls beautifully the Rosa Parks phenomenon. He says, there comes a point in a movement when the way it is can't be the way for you anymore. It's a very inward response. And when police came over to Rosa Parks on the bus and said that if she didn't move, she was going to go to jail, do you know what she said? She was very polite. She said, you may do that. You know why? Because the jail she was already in the racist society she was living in every day, didn't pale compared to the jail she was maybe going to go to. And that's the first stage. It's kind of that Laurie righteous indignation that we just heard before. You know, like, we've got to do something about this. That's the first stage of a movement. But then the second stage of a movement is you start getting a little scared, and you start saying, I'm really getting quite risky here. And does anybody else think like this? So this is where times like this, it's not just about a good conference. You know, we're waging peace here, you know. So it's about finding what he calls, Parker Palmer, communities of congruence that come together for that to happen. And then in stage three, the idea, the movement, and it doesn't all happen at once. Some people are in stage one, some are in stage two, some in stage three. Well, stage three happened for me on Wednesday when this book was released. Stage three is you have to start figuring out, well, how are you going to say it to the public? How are you going to begin to get the word out? What is the vision? What are the words? And in this stage, you have to know a little bit about what you're talking about, that's for sure, and be willing to put it under scientific investigation at that point. And be very respectful that we are always dealing with this work in classrooms with children. So we know what good pedagogy is. You know, is what we're going to bring in evidence-based? Are we willing to, you know, I don't do evaluations to get money. It seems that the money comes before. And that's been my path, whatever reason that is. I'm quite appreciative of it. But evaluations for us are about, are we doing what we think we're doing? Or we're just feeling good about what we're doing? That's what evaluations should be doing. That's what research should be doing. You know, James Garbarino said in a speech a couple of weeks ago when I was with him, some of you know he does a lot of work in trauma, he says, folks, those of you in the audience that are coming in from the outside trying to save our schools, please don't unless you know what you're doing. You know, so we really have to be careful about being respectful of what schools need. We have to give teachers a lot of help to do what they're doing. Although some of us are trying this expert technique of I'm the one that knows the meditation and I'm going into the classroom, I just want to say that the education research doesn't prove that out well. You may get some good results here and there in your own situations, but we find that you've got to work with the people that are with kids every day. Why? Because kids are going to get very confused. You know, this is the BioDoc, by the way, that we use and we just gave you to begin to see what are we talking about here? What are we talking about in terms of change in our physiology? What does that mean? We've got to have a sequential set of lessons, not just a bunch of activities. We wouldn't do that in math, so we can't do it in this. And we've got to use children's books, you know, and this came up quite a bit. There are so many wonderful books. Peaceful Piggy Meditation being one of them. Tom's principal gave that to every teacher in their school for a read aloud. This came up too. It's got to be infused in everything you're doing with teachers. So you've got to say to teachers, what are you doing for your class trips this year? Really? Project Adventure? Or the Adventure Park? Do you know you're right near the state park? You could get there in however much time. You know, you're near that pond in Central Park. Nature. Can't leave parents out. We haven't had a big talk about that. We've been very involved in parent workshops. What kids are learning, parents are learning. We're in this together. And then we've got to choose rituals that feel okay to everyone, that are void of a dogma. We use this bell purposely. Does this bell belong to a particular religion? No. Does this bell belong to a certain ideology? No. We use candles, but interestingly enough, we had to use battery candles for the kids because we couldn't do a light and, you know, flame in the room. So all of these candles that we bought were white. That's how they came. But our Chinese-American teachers walked into the training and said, oh, are they all white? We said, yeah. So they said, oh, that's not going to work for our kids. I said, tell me more. Well, white candle is death. really? So we painstakingly took permanent magic markers. You know, you always get creative. And now they're in all colors, just like those are, like the teachers. In our classrooms, we have peace corners. You're not only changing the content, but you're changing the structure of what happens in classrooms. You're getting at it from all ways. And we've said this before, but let's not forget, we're not trying to make kids good meditators. That's really not what we're doing. We're trying to make them loving, caring human beings who are going to be engaged in actively in the world to change it. Many ways we could integrate this throughout the day. We have been doing some of this in SEL, but I think the value that we're adding here to this is really the practice. Can't forget the teachers, and we get to stage four of the movement. Stage four of a movement is when the very institutions that gave you a hard time are telling you, this is a good thing, and I want it. Please don't go somewhere else. So it happened to us just the other day. I thought we were about a year away from this in New York City. Somebody at Central Board of Education in New York City calls us and says, I have a 5-year grant I'm applying for with the feds. I want to put in inner resilience. And I say, our research is going to be out only in September. She said, you know what it's going to say. Let's do it. Great. Stage four. I'd like to end with just a few words from one of the many books we use, and I really encourage you to use children's books. This is called A Quiet Place. Sometimes you need a quiet place, a place where there are no horns honking, no bells ringing, no grown-ups screaming. Maybe you could find that quiet place under a bush where all the world is quiet until your parent calls you to clean up your room. Maybe you could find it at the sea. But if your beach is not your cup of tea, maybe you could go find a little quiet place in the library. But if the library's not open, you might have to go to the very best place of all, right back to your own home, in your room, and find that place that is there no matter what, the one inside of you. I'd like to end with this quote that I love from the Bone People, and it's really to all of us. There were nothing more than people by themselves. Even paired, any pairing, they would have been nothing more than people by themselves, but all together, they have become the heart and muscles and mind of something perilous and new, something strange and growing and great. Together, all together, we are instruments of change. This is a picture of two twins, their first year of life. One twin was expected to thrive, and the other one was not. They were in separate incubators until a nurse who works inside of an institution decided in the middle of the night to put the one healthy baby with the other. And in about 10 seconds, the healthy baby put her arm of embrace around the other one. And about 30 seconds later, that baby's heart rate stabilized, and temperature went down, and they both lived a very happy, healthy life. May we learn in our work above all to help each other embrace ourselves with loving attention and therefore be able to see in each of us the other. Thank you.